Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to the LSE and to this lecture by Bruce Caldwell, HIEX Challenge. Our speaker, Bruce Caldwell, is the Joe Rosenthal Excellence Professor of Economics at the University of North Carolina at Greensboro. Professor Caldwell has held fellowships at New York University, Cambridge University, and in 2001-2 was the Lackman Fellow here in the Philosophy Department at the London School of Economics. Professor Caldwell's interests lie in the history and philosophy of economics. He is a past president of the History of Economics Society and a past executive director of the International Network for Economic Method. Early in his career, he wrote principally about economic methodology and was author of the book Beyond Positivism, Economic Methodology in the 20th Century. More recently, his research has focused on the history of economics, in particular, on the multifaceted writings of the Nobel Prize-winning economist and social theorist, Friedrich Hayek, who was, of course, a professor of economics here at the LSE from 1931 to around 1950. Professor Caldwell's writings on Hayek are twofold. First, he's the general editor of the collected works of Hayek, a 20-volume collection, and he's edited six of those volumes. Secondly, his intellectual biography of Hayek, titled Hayek's Challenge, was published this year by the University of Chicago Press, and I hope you've all noticed that it's outside and you have the opportunity of buying it on the way out if you've enjoyed the lecture.
Or even if you have.
The title Hayek's Challenge of the book here, I hope you can see it, that's right above, is the same title that his lecture has tonight. The book has, I'm sure, established him as the foremost authority on Hayek. I'm really delighted to introduce Professor Bruce Caldwell to give his lecture, Hayek's Challenge.
Well, as Mary said, I wrote this book when I was, or not all of it, but a great part of it when I was the Lackman Fellow here at the LSE. So I think actually the most appropriate place for me to start tonight is to thank the Charlottenburg Trust for funding the fellowship, and also for to thank the colleagues that I had while I was here at the LSE. There was a group of students. While I was writing each chapter, they would review it. They'd put me through my paces, make sure I wasn't saying anything too terribly stupid. And then at the end of the year, Mary actually read a draft copy as much as I had done, and her remarks on it were instrumental in bringing the book to whatever shape it finally got to at the end, quite different from where it began. So I want to express my thanks to all of them for that. I'm going to preface my remarks tonight by saying that I didn't come to Hayek, as so many people often have, as either a conservative or a libertarian. I came to Hayek principally as an historian of economic thought. I found him to be an interesting figure, and I think I'll give you some tidbits on him to indicate why an historian might find Hayek a figure that might be worth looking into. First of all, he lived a long time. He was born in 1899, died in 1992. Longevity is something that you really like when you're an historian looking for a figure. Secondly, he wrote a lot. He started writing in the 1920s. His last book was in 1988, and he was productive throughout the entire period. He wrote on a lot of different topics, which was also something that was quite attractive. There's a large archives. It's now up to about, I think, 120 boxes. It's still growing. There's still some things to be added. So these are all things that make historians shiver with delight. And another point is that he's controversial. This is a figure who some people like, some people don't like his ideas. So there's lots of things out there that people have written. And part of the historian's job is to, of course, try to interpret text and try to come up with plausible interpretations. So it's especially nice if you have some that you can disagree with as well. But the thing that really clinched it for me about Hayek was his knack for being in the right place at the right time. I'll just review a little bit of his personal history to give you some idea of what I mean by that. He was born in Fiandesecchia, my French is not good, Vienna, at a time that was perhaps the most interesting period in Western European history, I think, in terms of finding a place that had so many different intellectual currents going through it. That's what he grew up in. That was the milieu he was growing up in. His first teacher was Friedrich von Wieser, but he soon came under the influence of Ludwig von Mises, another towering figure in the Austrian School of Economics. One of his classmates, and who later went on to work with him at the Austrian Business Cycle Institute, was Oscar Morgenstern, one of the developers of game theory. After he finished his work at university, he decided to go to the United States. Joseph Schumpeter wrote him letters of introduction to all the famous economists. The only one who he didn't have a letter of introduction to was Wesley Clair Mitchell, who at that time was the leading American economist and was just at the moment that Hayek arrived making some very interesting contributions to the development of American institutionalism. Hayek comes back to Vienna, gets an invitation by Lionel Robbins. The students here know, but perhaps not all of you are from the LSE, but if you go to the LSE library, that's the Robbins Library, so another prominent LSE figure, invited him to the LSE to give some lectures. As a result of the lectures, he got an appointment here. As soon as he arrived in the early 1930s, he becomes embroiled in a debate with John Maynard Keynes. Now, Keynes was not yet the John Maynard Keynes of the general theory. The general theory was still 5 years off, but he was a pretty prominent economist, and so Hayek was mixing it up as soon as he hit the ground here in London with the big guys. There was a number of others that he debated with in the 1930s. He had a seminar jointly with Popper, Robbins, and one of the people that he brought through was a young Viennese philosopher of science, Karl Popper. He was also instrumental after World War II, not him alone, but with others to try to get Popper a position and successfully ultimately to get him a position here at the LSE. In 1948, he founded the Mont Pelerin Society, and a couple of the people who came there, George Stigler and Milton Friedman, ended up being people that he would become his colleagues when he moved to the University of Chicago in 1950, and he spent 12 years there. So what I'm trying to suggest is that there's some really rich stories here. This is a person who was interacting with virtually all of the most famous economists of the 20th century. And indeed, telling Hayek's story is a way to tell, I think, the story of 20th century economics from a very strange and different point of view, because he took a different view of things than many of his other economist fellows, but still a good figure for that. So that explains my interest. As I got deeper into the subject, as I tried to tell Hayek's story, I encountered a number of real challenges. And I point out that the book is titled Hayek's Challenge. I point out in the introduction that indeed, often I would think of the title of the book as Caldwell's Challenge, because it was a difficult book to write. There was all sorts of interpretive difficulties that I mentioned in the first chapter. But what I'm going to focus on tonight is a specific problem that I encountered. And it was the way he kept switching research topics. Hayek began his academic career as a monetary theorist working within the Austrian tradition. But when he came to London in the 1930s, about the middle of the decade, he switched from doing that kind of work to doing a critique of socialism. He joined the socialist calculation debate. In the 1940s, during the war years, he broadened out his economic attack on socialism into something much, much bigger. He called his project the Abuse of Reason Project. It had methodological elements. It had historical elements. It was a really broad-ranging attack on socialism. And part of that project is also his most famous book, The Road to Serfdom. That was a part and parcel of that larger project. He never finishes the project because in 1945 he pulls an essay that he'd written in 1920 out of the drawer, starts working on it, and this becomes a book in theoretical psychology called The Sensory Order. I have to say that it took me about a decade to figure out what was going on there. I mean, why does he make this sudden switch? He publishes this book on psychology, and as he goes to the University of Chicago, he switches again. He starts working on political philosophy. He also starts writing things in the philosophy of social sciences, the methodology of social sciences. So this is a pattern that he follows throughout his life of switching around, and it cried out for explanation. I mean, why was he doing this? First of all, the audacity of it was overwhelming, and it became very difficult for someone who's a specialist, as I am, in one field to try to make sense of his contributions to these variety of different fields. But why keep switching subjects? What was going on? How can we make sense of that strange sort of intellectual odyssey? Now, I think I've come up with a plausible account in the book, and obviously, because I don't expect you to sit here until tomorrow morning, I'm not going to be able to tell you the whole story, but I thought what I'd do is pick out a couple of what I think are significant events during this long march, and see if we can give you some sense of how my initial interest in Hayek actually ends up turning to fascination as time went on. In telling Hayek's story, I don't start with Hayek. I start with the Austrian School of Economics in the book, and I'm going to do that to a little extent tonight because I think it's important background, and hopefully by the end you'll see what I mean. I'm going to start tonight with Karl Menger, his 1871 book, The Principles of Economics, is a founding document of the Austrian School of Economics, and Menger is typically introduced in his stories, histories of thought, as one of the three co-founders of marginalism, and along with Bolrat and Jevons, and therefore a co-founder of microeconomics. I think it's essential to emphasize that this was not what Menger thought he was up to. To understand Menger's particular contributions and where he thought he was coming from, you have to bring into the account the German historical school. The German historical school economists believed that a theoretical approach to the social sciences was problematic. They rejected the generalizing methods of Ricardo and the British classicals that was attempting to produce a theory of the social sciences, a theory of economics, as premature, and they accused them of generalizing basically from the narrow experience of Britain, and they didn't think that that experience applied to other countries. The German historical school economists argued that each country has its own unique background, its own unique culture, cultural institutions, ethical institutions, economic institutions, social institutions, and that to understand the development of a country, you had to go and examine the development of each one of those institutions, see how they interact, see how they compare to other countries' institutions. Some of them had stage theories. Gustav Schmoller argued for the patient collection of lots and lots and lots of facts, but basically they denied that a theoretical approach to the social sciences was possible. Now, Karl Menger agreed with the German historical school economists on one thing. He indeed dedicated his book to one of the leading historical school economists, Roscher. But what he agreed with them was that the value theory that had been put forth by the British classical economists, the labor theory of value or cost of production theory of value, was wrong. He thought that this was not the appropriate theory. But he disagreed with them in terms of their claim that, therefore, theory should be out the window altogether when you're dealing with the social sciences. He put in its place a new value theory, and he basically said that a theoretical approach to society was possible, and his evidence for it was basically what his book was. The 1871 book, The Principles of Economics, was an attempt to provide a new theory. He was interested, as the German historical school economists were, in the evolution of institutions, and what he did in the book was to talk about the origins of a number of market institutions and social institutions, mostly market, actually, origins of money, trade, price formation, various sorts of market structures. He said all of these could be explained as the unintended results of intentional human action. This was his major claim. Now, what that means is that people did not consciously set out to create these institutions. They simply behaved purposefully, and the institutions are unintended and, in that sense, spontaneous orders. This was a claim that Menger made. Another battle that the Austrian school economists fought was against Marxism and the philosophical doctrines of positivism, which were emerging together in pre-World War I Vienna. I think it's important to emphasize that the Austrian economists typically associated positivism and socialism together. Now, most mainstream economists today, if you say the word positivism, they think of The Methodology of Positive Economics, an essay that Milton Friedman wrote in the 1950s, published in the 1950s. So they many people tend to equate positivism, Friedman, markets. Well, that was not the equation that the Austrian school economists had. They said positivism and socialism are two things that work together. There's actually another wonderful story here. Just briefly, there was a seminar before World War I run by one of the second generation Austrian economists, Eugen Böhm-Bewerk. And this seminar gathered together a remarkable group of people. Schumpeter was a member of the seminar. Otto Bauer was a member of the seminar. Bauer was the leader of the Social Democrats in Red Vienna. Rudolf Hilferding, one of the leading Marxist theoreticians, was a member of the seminar. Indeed, the first meeting of the seminar, Böhm-Bewerk and Hilferding went at each other's value theory, a subjective value theory that Böhm-Bewerk was defending, Marxist theory that Hilferding was defending. Ludwig von Mises was a member, and also Otto Neurath, who would become the social science representative in the Vienna Circle of Logical Positivists. And this was just a remarkable group of people. Von Mises, reporting later, said that the one person that really drove him crazy was Otto Neurath. This was the one guy that he didn't like him personally, and he liked his views perhaps less. Neurath advocated running, the term that he used was war economy, but he wanted to run a peacetime economy using the same principles that a nation might use at a time of war, where the decisions were made from central planning bureaus. He actually argued that it should be a moneyless economy, that all of the decisions should be taken from the center based on objective statistics that were gathered by various experts in the social sciences. It was in response to Neurath that von Mises initiated what's been called the German language socialist calculation debate. What Mises argued in that was that you have to have a monetary economy with freely adjusting market prices for relative scarcities to be revealed when you're trying to make production decisions. Now, that would be a reasonable way of stating the argument that von Mises made, but von Mises, whenever he could, wouldn't be reasonable, he'd be provocative. The way he made the point was to say that rational production under socialism was impossible. Okay, fairly dramatic way of putting things, and the significance of which will be clear soon. So the twin forces then of socialism and positivism were something that the Austrian economists were dealing with even back in the pre-war years. Hayek comes along, goes to university after World War I. He can see these influences in the various debates about socialization that were taking place in Vienna and elsewhere. It also colored his trip to the United States. Remember I said he went to the States and encountered Wesley Clair Mitchell. Mitchell, at that very moment that he appeared, had just become the president of the American Economic Association, and in his address to the association had made provocative statements about the way that economics is being done now is wrong. We need to replace it with a different approach. So he was a critic of mainstream economics. And I think that if you think of the background that I've just given you, Hayek's response to Mitchell was fairly predictable. Mitchell, one of the arguments that Mitchell made was that we should study institutions. He's the father of American institutionalism, and that was part and parcel of the program that he was recommending. And of course, to an Austrian, this sounds like a German historical school economist. And Mitchell wasn't a German historical school economist. Indeed, had written criticisms of the German historical school, but to Hayek's ears, that's what he was. Mitchell had also criticized the convention of using rational economic man. He wanted to abandon subjective value theory, replace it with behavioral economics. And behavioral economics says that you should only deal with observable things. You shouldn't talk about intentions and mental states. So you just look at behavior. Well, this emphasis on the observable, in fact, sounds very much like Otto Neurath's physicalist philosophy of science. So he also sounded like a positivist. So he sounded like a German historical school economist and a positivist. Couldn't be good in Hayek's view, coming from the tradition he did. Anyway, part of that background is just to get some sense of what the contending debates were. Another point I want to make is that no matter which party you looked at, when they were trying to say that my ideas are right and my opponent's ideas are wrong, the way they said it is, I'm the real scientist. Okay, the claiming that the mantle of science was something that every one of the groups was attempting to do and is important as part of the story. I'm now ready finally, I'm sure you are as well, to get to Hayek. And I'm going to skip over a lot of the story. I'm not going to talk about the Vienna period or his debate with Keynes or his early coming to the LSE. There's some great stories there for sure. What I want to do is go directly to 1937 when he published a paper called Economics and Knowledge. And he, in retrospectives, he always said this was an important paper. Indeed, in the secondary literature, people mark it as the beginning of his transformation from a narrow economist to a broad social theorist. So it's a good paper to look at. As I note in the book, there were a whole bunch of things that were pushing Hayek in the direction of writing the things that he did in this paper. But one of the most important elements of it was the socialist calculation debate. During the mid-1930s, most of the intelligentsia in Britain viewed socialism as the middle way, that basically you wanted to avoid totalitarianism of the right and the left, of fascism and communism, and everyone said, well, socialism is the right way to do that. In Hayek's opinion, this was wrong. So what he did was to contribute a book called Collectivist Economic Planning. It was a book that he provided an introduction for, and a final chapter for. And the middle part of the book was the translation of a bunch of papers that were appropriated from the German language of socialist calculation debate. Some of them were actually even earlier than that. So among the papers that he translated then was Ludwig von Mises's paper, where he said that rational production under socialism is impossible. Now, the socialist response to his initial foray, it was diverse, but one of the prominent ones was to invoke general equilibrium theory. This is particularly ironic because one of Hayek's things that Hayek and Robbins both did was to introduce some of these continental literatures to the British economists. So he was one of the people that helped introduce general equilibrium theory. But anyway, general equilibrium theory basically states that any economy can be represented with a system of equations, by a system of equations. And what the socialist economists who invoked general equilibrium theory were claiming was, they said, well, if any economy can be represented by a system of equations, there isn't really any difference between a socialist economy and a market economy. In a market economy, markets solve the equations. In a socialist economy, socialist planners solve the equations. So rational production under socialism is not impossible after all. That was, in a nutshell, the sort of argument that was being made. Now, Hayek, of course, disagreed with this. And what it led him to do was to say, well, wait a second, what is it about the specific tools of economics that could lead to this kind of conclusion? I disagree with the conclusion. I wonder if perhaps the tools of economics are not really revealing the way I think markets work. This was Hayek's position. In Economics and Knowledge, Hayek decides to change some of the assumptions. One of the assumptions of general equilibrium theory is that all agents have access to the same information and that that information is correct. So all agents have the same correct information. In Economics and Knowledge, Hayek posits a world where that's different, where every agent, in fact, has access to a specific bit of knowledge. The way he put it was that knowledge is dispersed. And furthermore, some agents can be wrong, that knowledge claims are subjective. People have their own perceptions. Sometimes those perceptions are wrong. So that's a very different world from the one posited in general equilibrium theory. He thought it was a better description of the world. And he says, well, given that that's the way the world is, or given that kind of description of the world, how does social coordination in such a world ever take place? Now, he never answers the question in that article. He does come up with a definition of equilibrium that has to do with people's expectations. But it seemed to him, at a minimum, that's what he calls static equilibrium theory, with the assumption that all agents have access to the same and correct information, clearly just avoids the question. It assumes it away. And he thought that that was not good. Hayek would grapple with this problem for a number of years. His ultimate solution was to talk about the market as a key institution for coordinating dispersed knowledge. In his vision, he postulates a market process, a world of constant change in which freely adjusting market prices are formed as a result of decisions made by people. Now, these decisions are often forward-looking. People engaging in market activities are often thinking about the future in making their decisions. And it's literally millions upon millions of agents that are making these decisions. They're basing their decisions on dispersed knowledge, on the little bits of knowledge that they have. He starts using phrases like knowledge of particular circumstances of time and place. In his later work, he develops the notion of tacit knowledge, knowledge that drives people in making decisions, but they can't really tell you why. That maybe they've just worked in a market for 20 or 30 years and they've past experiences such that they think this is the right time to make this particular move. Now, what they're trying to do is to improve themselves, their purposeful behavior. So they're looking at market prices, and that affects their behavior. But the behavior of these millions and millions of people are also what creates the market prices, that array of prices that exists out there. So this vast, complex, and ever-changing array of prices is what he calls the market order. And the market system itself, then, is another example of a complex, spontaneous order, an order that is formed not because people say, let's create an order, but their very individual actions are what give rise to this order. I'm not going to talk about Hayek's contributions to political theory in this talk tonight, but I think it is appropriate to mention here that Hayek always emphasized that a market system had to be embedded in a host of other social institutions if it was to do any of this sort of work in terms of preserving, generating, and coordinating knowledge. Among the ones that he emphasized was a democratic polity, a private sphere of economic activity that was protected by a strong constitution, the rule of law, another phrase that he used quite often, well-defined, enforced, exchangeable property rights. These were all the sorts of things that he, in his later political work, said you have to have them in conjunction, and when you do, it's no guarantee, but you have the best possibility of getting that kind of coordination of knowledge. This, by the way, is why Hayek's work, I think, is so attractive to people like Douglas North, people affiliated with the new institutional economics and other movements, because he does try to take this more wide-ranging view rather than simply being an economist. Well, let's go back to the end of the 1930s. He had made all these great arguments, and nobody believed him. Keynes was winning debates about macroeconomics, what later becomes called macroeconomics. The intelligentsia didn't believe him about socialism. And among economists, the best treatment he got was to say, well, the debate was a draw. So Hayek says, what shall I do at this point? This is when he embarks on the Abuse of Reason project. Now, this was a really big project that he had envisioned initially, one that he never finished. But his goal, you can see him adjusting, because he's recognizing his arguments are not going through, that people aren't buying them. And his approach in this larger project is to say, well, I think I'm right, they think I'm wrong, let's see if I can figure out what sorts of influences, intellectual influences, would set up a situation so that people's ideas are going to be congenial to what he thought were mistakes. Basically try to explain the origins of their erroneous beliefs. That would be his way of looking at it. Now, a central essay that he completed in this was something called Scientism and the Study of Society. Scientism is something that he defined as the slavish following of the methods of the natural sciences in areas where they do not apply. In his essay, he criticized what he called the objectivism and historicism and collectivism of the scientific approach, and he contrasts this, think of the contrast of the opposites, or not necessarily opposites, but things that can be the opposites of those three words, an approach that's subjectivist, theoretical, and individualist. This is the approach that he thought would be the preferred approach, and indeed this is an approach that is very similar to what Menger was advocating. So in this early essay, the scientism essay, he was definitely being influenced by Menger. In the book, I characterize the scientism essay as a bit of a transitional piece. I'm mentioning it here for a couple of reasons. It was in this essay that he first came up with some of his central ideas about the limitations of certain sciences, where he came up with the idea, in this essay, it was the social sciences are limited. Often the best we can do in the social sciences is make pattern predictions or provide explanations of the principle by which some phenomena occurs. But he made that distinction in natural science versus social science. The other reason I mentioned the scientism essay is I told you before, I could never explain the sensory order. Finally, after years of work, I hit on the idea that in fact the sensory order came directly out of the scientism essay. Indeed, he was working on the scientism essay right before, so it actually is a logical place to look. Just very briefly, on that sensory order bit, in the scientism essay, behaviorism was one of the targets. Scientism is the overriding body, and then he had objectivism, collectivism, and historicism. Under the objectivism part, he has behaviorism. Behaviorism, again, that doctrine associated with Mitchell, but also, obviously, within psychology, it was becoming a leading doctrine. The idea that you only make reference to observable states, you don't make reference to intentions. That's not allowed if you're being really scientific. Okay, so behaviorism states that, and Otto Neurath, physicalism, the idea that you can only make reference to observable states if you're going to be doing real science. These two things, in a sense, you can think of physicalism as providing a philosophical justification for the psychological position of behaviorism. So these were two of the targets that he identified in the scientism essay. And it's my contention in the book that at least initially, the initial impetus for writing the sensory order, for digging that paper out and putting together this book, was to provide what he viewed as a scientific critique of behaviorism and physicalism. I'm not going to go into the details of Hayek's psychological theory. I'll simply note here that what he does is it's called the sensory order because he posits two different orders. The sensory order, which is what people experience, the senses that they experience, the fact that you're looking up here and seeing a person talking, this sort of sensory order is one thing, and then there's the natural order or physical order that underlies it, that we know that in fact this is made of atoms and molecules and things that we can't observe in that way, but that natural scientists tell us the way the world is actually structured. Now the question arises, why is the sensory order, the thing that we experience, different from what natural scientists tell us is the actual natural order? Hayek posited as his answer that basically the sensory order is a product of our brains, that we have millions upon millions of connections, perhaps billions of connections in our brains, and that the brain is basically a huge classification system. It has those sets of connections. It also is a hierarchical structure, and he ends up describing a classifier system of great complexity. I have to lift this. I left my glasses in there, so I have to get a little closer to my eyes. At one point, he quotes I think this is a wonderful quote, he quotes a biologist that's trying to explain just how complex the mind is. The number of neuronal connections made during a few minutes of intense cortical activity, like perhaps some of you are experiencing now, as being 10 to the 56th, which is the total number of atoms in the solar system. That's the number of connections that you make in periods of... Now, of course, the solar system was smaller then. This was written back in the 1960s. It's not as big as we know it is to be now. But still, that's still pretty darn big. Okay, that's a lot of connections. Anyway, Hayek thought that his theory, if it was right, would cause problems for both behaviorism and physicalism. Neither one even recognized, first of all, the existence of the two orders. They basically took the sensory order as foundational, and they certainly didn't recognize that the sensory order, which they thought was an uninterpreted sensory order, that was the whole point, that you didn't, it was just something that everyone could see, was in fact itself a product of the mind. So he felt that this was a criticism, and he made other criticisms, but this was the basic criticism that he was making. Now, although it began as a critique of behaviorism and physicalism, the sensory order soon started to play a much more important role in Hayek's ideas. Basically, if you think about what I've just described, you've got millions of synapses firing that creates basically what is called the brain or the mind, and that mind creates consciousness. He started to think of the mind as yet another example of how individual agents interacting create something that, I mean, the synapses are not attempting to create consciousness, but indeed consciousness is something that comes out of it. So another example of a spontaneously organized complex order. And this work that he did on the brain, as well as other work that he was doing in Chicago, he started reading a whole bunch of different, very, very different people from whom he'd been reading before, John von Neumann on the logic of automata, Ludwig von Bertalanffy on general systems theory, Norbert Wiener on cybernetics. He attended and participated in a Darwin Centennial at Chicago. Warren Weaver on simple, complex, and phenomena of organized complexity. These are the sorts of things that starts citations that start appearing in his published work. So he's really going through a period of fairly intense activity. And it's in the mid-50s and then increasingly in his later work, he goes back to that idea of pattern prediction and explanation of the principle, but now he doesn't distinguish it according to natural versus social sciences, but makes the distinction on the grounds of sciences that study simple versus those that study complex phenomena. And this would end up being his basic dividing line among the sciences. Well, in my remarks tonight, I just tried to give you a little bit of a view on some of the issues that I was trying to deal with in trying to tell Hayek's story. In my conclusion, I want to say that though my book is about Hayek, quite obviously, it's also about some other stuff. In the first instance, it's about history, and it's about history, I think, on a lot of different levels. First of all, obviously, it is itself a contribution to intellectual history. Secondly, as I said earlier, I found it a real challenge, the interpretive issues that I came up against, the alternative interpretations that are plausible interpretations for any given episode are something that I had to deal with, and I certainly found it a challenge, but also something quite enjoyable. I mean, it was a real part of the book. I put alternative interpretations, I try to tell my own story in the text, but there's a number of appendices where I try to deal with what other people have argued about aspects of Hayek's contribution. History also is quite important as a topic in the book, because the German historical school economists, perhaps most evidently, were arguing that this is the right way to do economics. The whole idea of a debate between an approach that emphasizes theory versus one that emphasizes empirical work or an historical approach. But beyond all of those, the book is also about the history of economic thought. Every one of the major protagonists that I mention in the book, Menger, Gustav Schmoller, Wesley Clair Mitchell, Lionel Robbins, Hayek himself, all had recourse, attempted to do the history of economic thought. And they often did it not as professional historians, but as people who are economists who are reflecting on their own discipline. So it was an exercise in reflection, and it also was often an exercise in criticism. Now, for those of you who are economists, you know that the history of economic thought is a field that is gradually being eliminated at lots of graduate institutions. It's not being taught. If you're students out there and you want it to be taught, make sure you tell your professors that, okay, so they don't get away with it. But in lots of places, indeed, it is being gradually and very slowly, but fairly systematically eliminated. As a result, this self-criticism, this self-reflection that I think the history of economic thought provides is something that is going away. And indeed, it's my contention that if you think about economics as a profession, it indeed is one of the least self-reflective professions. It's not a profession where people sit around thinking about economics in the way that some of these greats in the past did. In my closing chapter, I argue that this is one of the final legacies, actually, of positivism. If you're a positivist, you think that science builds up steadily, steady accumulation of theories that are true. The past is simply past errors that have been eliminated. As a result, you don't need to know history. So part and parcel of the positivist approach is to have a real disdain for the history of ideas and history in general. I argue, to end somewhat provocatively, throughout his life, Hayek was fighting against socialism and against positivism. And at least among the economics profession, I think that many people have accepted his arguments about some of the limitations of socialism. But I maintain that indeed, positivism is still something that has not been eradicated by any means, and indeed is quite as strong as it ever was in the economics profession. That's something I lament, but perhaps it might change. Well, that's it for now, so Thank you.
You mentioned Hayek's belief that property rights are important in a modern economy, and I seem to remember reading somewhere that Hayek did not take the same view of intellectual property rights, that he believed that intellectual property rights created scarcity where there was no genuine scarcity. Suppose the utilitarian school, that you have to have intellectual property rights to ensure incentives for innovation. Is that true? I could be wrong.
I'm not sure. I think probably the place that he would have discussed that would have been in the last third of the Constitution of Liberty, which was published in 1960, and in a sense is something that would have reflected a lot of the economics in Chicago of 1960. And I think some of the later developments in the property rights literature would have been subsequent to that. I'm not sure if he ever went back and, to my knowledge, he didn't go back and modify the sorts of claims he was making in the Constitution of Liberty, but I think in the Fatal Conceit he at least mentioned a couple of the names of people who had been doing more recent work in property rights theory. So,
questions?
Thank you. I was always wondering how somebody like Hayek, who was, if I may say that, I don't mean it in a pejorative sense, but an arch liberal, how can he reconcile that? He says, you know, in the end it should be the individual that is somehow the norm of what happens in society, and there is no such thing as collective goals and all that, and that's why he criticized this rage of planning as he perceived it. Now, at the same time, how can an arch-liberal argue against a majority of people who are happy to, you know, go for collectivization, for social planning, and whatever? What is an argument of somebody who is liberal? Because at the same time, he didn't take the easy way out and had a conspiracy theory like, you know, the elites suppress the poor individuals. He didn't do that, but at the same time, I sometimes wonder how can you have a coherent liberalism that, at the same time as you described it, has to think about how can it be that these erroneous beliefs get hold in society at large?
It seems to me there's about seven different things in there, and I'm not going to be able to address all of them. I think in terms of Hayek's view of individualism, the best paper to look at is Individualism, True and False, where he has a description of individuals that are certainly well situated within society. He doesn't take an atomistic approach to the description of the role of an individual in society. And I think another way of getting at some of the issues that you raise in your question is at times Hayek would be putting forward his own views of what he saw as the set of institutions that he thinks are going to best promote liberty and the coordination of knowledge, the creation of knowledge. At other times his level of analysis was much more of a meta-analysis, where he stepped back from it and said different societies are going to try different experiments and with differing results. Let's see if we can figure out what we think what we expect the outcomes are going to be. So, I mean, sometimes indeed he is making his own claims about what he thinks is the best way to organize society, and other times he's doing something quite different. And I think a lot of the tensions that people perceive in some of Hayek's work have to do with those different levels and him not being very clear in mixing them up. Now, you also, you're not John Gray, are you? No. So you sounded a bit like John Gray when you said, of course, liberalisms can't be. There's no consistent political philosophy that, and he went through and criticized a whole host of types of liberalisms in some of his kind of middle period work. And indeed, I mean, one of the arguments that Gray makes is that in a sense, political philosophy should be a prophylactic against ever thinking that you can have a consistent political philosophy, that a consistent philosophy. And that, you know, that's something that I think is a very attractive point of view, frankly, so.
Maybe I can ask a question here, Bruce. Can you explore a little bit more about the relationship between Hayek's theory of the brain and modern conceptions of the theory of the brain? I mean, are his theories completely outdated, or do they link up in some way to the more recent views of how the brain works?
I was at a meeting, excuse me, in the summer at Great Barrington, Massachusetts. The meeting was on Dewey, Hayek, and embodied cognition. That was the title of it. And there were economists there, there were sociologists there, there were historians of thought, there were brain scientists. And one of the brain scientists who was there was a Nobel Prize winner, Gerald Edelman. And I think Edelman actually has written to some extent on Hayek, and his view anyway is that although Hayek certainly got some things wrong, that Edelman was amazed, basically the idea of the brain as an hierarchical classifying system is something that, at least in Edelman's view, was something that he thought was quite reasonable. And in fact, at the conference, he mostly was just saying it's incredible that Hayek was coming up with the specific arguments that he was 60 years ago. Or 50 years ago, because the state of the science was such that people didn't know that. There was no way to verify the sorts of claims he was making. So at least Edelman is one person who I think there are certain views in brain science that view him fairly sympathetically. A man named Fuster, I'm not sure the pronunciation, is another one who's written about that. Now, I'm an historian of economic thought, so I have no expertise in this in this area, but I can just recount what others have said.
Questions? Sorry, I'll take this one first.
Hayek was very aware of the limitation of the human rationality, and he against all of the man-made institutions. And like socialism, he regarded it as a man-made institution, and he's very pro capitalism, and the think is as an extended order of extended human, it's extended order. So how do you think about, because it seems like a kind of inconsistence with this argument. So how do you think of that, please?
I'm not sure what, if you could specify where you see the inconsistency. I heard that you said that he was an opponent of constructivist rationalism, right?
Actually, he's against almost all the man-made institutions.
Right. Okay.
For example, as I regard it, a constitution of United States is a man-made institution.
Okay, I got you. Okay, right. Part of it, I think, it may be that Hayek's inconsistent, but let's see if I can say what he said in a way that may make it seem less inconsistent. Okay. One thing is that he's arguing against constructivist rationalism, the idea that you can simply go in overnight and change institutions en masse, okay? He clearly thought that was dangerous because it could have unintended consequences that were negative. To make your point stronger, you say, well then how could Hayek have come up with this constitution of his own, or plans about denationalization of money that were very specific in law, legislation, and liberty? Isn't there a conflict between him saying you can't construct institutions and the fact that he's proposing new types of institutions? Okay, that might be one way to put the argument that you were making. Is that, and my way of trying to say, well, one way to read it is he's just inconsistent. He's making lots of mistakes. I think another way to read it is to make that distinction that I was trying to make earlier, where he has a specific set of institutions that he thinks are going to be effective for various purposes. His concern was mostly with knowledge. He mentions liberty, and liberty is important to him, but frankly, you know, from the 30s, it was trying to figure out ways to have a society use knowledge more effectively. So those are his proposals, and that larger evolutionary take on things is where he's saying, okay, how is it that society changes, how our cultural evolution plays a very big role in his later work, where he's looking at not his own specific proposals, but is stepping back and doing a meta-analysis of how certain things change. And he's made arguments on that level, I think, that are on a different level from the arguments that he's making when he's talking about specific incidences of constructivist rationalism.
Thank you.
Out of curiosity, in your writings or your research, do you perceive any significant similarities between Hegg's political and social theories and, let's say, J.S. Mill's school of thought? I mean, do you see any significant consistencies between Hayek's political views and that of the traditional classical libertarian tradition?
I think you probably have something in your mind about what the relationship might be. I can just mention that, of course, Hayek did a lot of work on Mill in the early 1950s. It was a very strange thing that he edited the correspondence between Harriet Taylor and John Stuart Mill. It seems to me that Hayek's views on Mill went through a bit of an evolution through time, that he may have started out with a much more sympathetic reading of Mill and then later tended to think that Mill was one of the people that got Britain on the road to being more open to socialism. This is one of the sections, though, that I haven't really, you know, specialized on his work on Mill. I can tell you, though, that I've just gotten a very good person who's going to be the editor of that. There will be a volume in the collected works that's going to be exclusively on Mill. So, if you're writing a paper about it, it's that doesn't do you much good. But in the future, there will be a lot that will be said about that topic.
Yeah, please.
Very much. The world today seems to conform to the view that the vision that Hayek would like, I think, more so than when he was writing works like The Road to Freedom with the critique of planning and the onslaught on planning and so on and so forth. The fact that the world seems closer to his desire, is that proof for you of the veracity and the truth of his position? I mean, do the worst no longer get on top?
In a way, what's interesting to me is that Hayek has been attributed with predicting that socialism was going to the road to serfdom, that the worst would get on top if certain institutions were adopted, and so he's supposed to be someone who predicted the end of free market liberalism, and he's also attributed with predicting the collapse of the Soviet Union and the collapse of communism. So, in a sense, Hayek has been attributed with predicting both the successes of communism, that it would, that bury us, and also with its ultimate end. And I think if you've got a situation where people are interpreting you as being able to predict both of those things, now of course he's going to end up being right, I guess. My particular take on it is that Hayek was actually very suspicious of any kind of historical prediction. So he wouldn't have been making claims that he could predict the laws of history. It is an interesting time, but I don't believe in any end of history sort of things. I think things can change in a heartbeat. So,
more questions? Okay, well, I'd like to, in a second, ask you to thank Bruce, but before I do so, I'd like to point out that I hope you'll think of following this lecture by buying the book, which is outside, but much more important perhaps for your well-being is that you're invited to a reception in the Senior Common, which is the fifth floor of the old building. So I hope you'll join us up there for a glass of wine and to continue giving your questions to Bruce. Bruce, I'd like to thank you for a really informative, stimulating and erudite talk, and I hope you've all enjoyed it as much as I have. Thank you.
Thanks.